we can't really ask people and young people to be at their full creative best if they're not in an inclusive environment that really has that those cultural connections and, you know, just people can thrive. That cultural competence is a big part of your creative thinking and creative growth as well.
Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Cindy Burnett.
And my name is Dr. Matthew Werwood.
This is the Fueling Creativity Podcast.
On this show, we'll be talking about creativity topics and how they apply to the field of education.
We'll be speaking with scholars, educators, and resident experts about their work, challenges they face, and digging deeper into new and varying perspectives of creativity.
All with the goal to help fuel a more rich and informed discussion that provides teachers and parents with knowledge they can use at home or in the classroom.
So let's begin.
Welcome to another episode of the Fueling Creativity Podcast, another super duper episode where we're going to be speaking with Janine Letford on multicultural creativity. However, before we get into that episode, we want to alert you to a super duper exciting opportunity that is coming to you from Creativity in Education. Cindy, why don't you tell us a little bit more about this opportunity?
Thank you, Matt. So Creativity in Education will be hosting our upcoming guest that you'll be hearing today, Janine Letford, in a 90-minute workshop. And you can find this in the link below. And if you'd like to learn more about intercultural creativity and Janine's work, I hope that you'll check out the workshop and sign up.
And just to point out, Cindy, there's lots of other workshops on creativity in education. The URL is creativityineducation.com. And you and I have just been talking about the fact that this might be the beginning of multiple workshops that we center around some of our episodes.
Absolutely, Matt. And we would love to hear from you what kind of workshops you would like to see through creativity in education. So feel free to drop me a line at questions@fuelingcreativitypodcast.com.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Cindy. And for everyone who's listening now, we hope you enjoy our interview with Janine Letford.
Today, we welcome Janine Letford. Janine is the founder and chief creative officer at Cafe Strategies LLC, which trains employees to create sustainable organizational inclusion strategies while unleashing their innovative thinking for themselves and in their organizations. Her recent book, The Seven Gems of Intercultural Creativity, which just came out in November, provides a framework that encourages organizations with their diversity and inclusion development. Janine is a former educator and has a master's degree in education. She was also the recipient of the 2015 Charter School Teacher of the Year in California. Welcome, Janine.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start off with your book, which I've been able to read and really enjoyed, about intercultural creativity, which is a term you have actually coined. Is that correct?
That is correct. Coined and trademarked.
Coined and trademarked. So can you explain what you mean by intercultural creativity?
Sure. So in my 15 years in the classroom, I've always known that creativity was very, very important, but I really wanted to really define what creativity is. And as you know, a lot of people may have some myths around that word. A lot of people think it's only artistry and they are saying that they're not creative because they're not artists. And so I really wanted to make sure people understood the vastness of that word and that creativity spans all fields, all disciplines, all people. And yes, the arts are important and I'm a huge advocate for the arts, but I just want everyone to really redefine creativity, especially as we go forward. So once I left the classroom in 2019, 6 months before the pandemic hit, I was really on the push of creativity. And then when I noticed within the K-12 classroom and the workforce boardroom and workroom that we can't really ask people and young people to be at their full creative best if they're not in an inclusive environment that really has that those cultural connections and, you know, just people can thrive. That cultural competence is a big part of your creative thinking and creative growth as well. So I saw the intersection between those two developmental patterns. And that's really what creativity is about, right? Like looking at things in a new way and seeing connections. And then the term intercultural creativity came up because I saw that the developmental process for both of these, they're very aligned. They're very aligned. So cultural competence is, you know, your ability to really connect with people from different lived backgrounds, to be observant of similarities and differences, and to see with complexity and perspective shift and adapt your behavior. There's people who are really good at that, and that's a developmental aspect. And so creativity is a lot along the same way. It's a developmental aspect that you can really improve if you focus on it and practice it, as you know. And so I saw the intersection and I said, well, what about intercultural creativity? And this brainchild was born.
Before I ask my next question, I've made a really weird connection to some past episodes where we kind of looked at what are the values that human beings bring to the future of creative production in a world with artificial intelligence. And we, you know, in that discussion, we spent a lot of time talking about the people aspect, because we as people have the ability to observe and respond to interactions taking place in our environment. So thinking about the way people observe, interact in our environment, the way existing behaviors and beliefs and values can all come together to motivate and influence those interactions. How do we, in a classroom environment, help students become more aware of, one, the value they bring as humans, as people, and two, some of the things that they need to be aware of and sensitive to when ideating and selecting and evaluating outcomes in an environment where there are potentially a lot of diverse and different perspectives and views to consider? That was a loaded question, right?
Yes, and a very fun one as well. And so all of my research is backed in neuroscience and education and the human developmental process. So I bring all of that to this answer. Cultural capital is huge, especially as an educator. You know, in the old ways, you know, 10 years ago, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, it was like the child comes to the classroom and the teacher stuffs all this new knowledge into the child, right? And we have our standards. You need to know this and this and this by this grade and so on and so forth. And so as we progress in the neuroscience of what's actually going on in the brain, as we progress in how the brain actually learns and what it lights up the brain, you know, the fMRI has only been on the scene since like the 1990s. So this is still relatively a lot of new information. Knowing that the cultural capital and the cultural experiences that the children are coming in with is key. That is gold, because the brain doesn't learn by just throwing new information to it. The brain learns through integration, by integrating new information to already learned information. And so if the teacher or the educator or who's ever in the classroom doesn't know what the child already knows and what is important to the child, that integration is low. So teachers who spend a lot of that foundational time, you know, at the beginning of the year, understanding their student, understanding their lived experiences, understanding how they're interacting with the environment in the classroom, the environment within the curriculum is huge. Another aspect that really lights the brain up is when the brain can see similarities between what's going on within its own life, the child's life, and what's going on in the curriculum. And so even now, but definitely in the past, we've had curriculum that we've chosen without really the child in mind. And there's only one voice, you know, like the main dominant voice that chooses what the child learns. And now we're really seeing that culture is important, and making meaning is very, very important. And for the child to see that they're in this life story, especially within American story, that only some stories are told, and looking at how the demographics are changing, a lot of these stories are not being told, and we're starting to wake up that children learn better when they get a variety and a diversity of stories that includes stories from their own experience. And one short story is my brother, who works for JPL NASA in Pasadena, California. I asked him after the film came out of Hidden Figures about Katherine Johnson, the African-American woman mathematician who worked for NASA. I said, you know, Joseph, have you ever heard of this person? Because I didn't know who she was. And he was like, no, not until the film came out. And I was like, wow, Joseph, you're a mathematician. This is what you do. You work at NASA now, and you have never heard of Katherine Johnson. And so it's those incidences that are robbing our young students of all colors, you know, all ethnicities, but especially students of color, of our young women, from seeing these stories that will make them even more engaged in the content and learning. So that's the first section of your question, them coming in with cultural capital.
Thank you. And I think, you know, a big takeaway that I have is that as teachers, we need to sit and observe how students are making meaning or constructing meaning in this learning experience. And then when it comes to ideating, selecting ideas, and evaluating outcomes, we need to probably recognize that there are going to be multiple perspectives on how to select the ideas and how to evaluate the outcomes. And I think as teachers, it's part of our responsibility to make sure that it's not being dominated by one view or one voice.
It's knowing that the landscape that you and I came up in, you know, I don't know exactly how old you are, but I came up in the 80s and the 90s. That basically is done. Just the VUCA, right? The term that the business world is using, taken by the military world, this VUCA environment, volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous, is where we're sending our kids into. And so for them to grow their cultural competence and to grow their ability to perspective shift and adapt, it's something in my seven gems I call the authentic adaptation, they're going to have to learn how to perspective shift. And so what great place to do that is within the K-12 experience, correct? And another aspect is what you'll love, because this is what you do. The neuroscience is showing that Gardner's work was on point. We now have the brain research to back it up. So multiple intelligences. It's not just about logic and math. We looked at where the brain is being highly engaged when you are supporting the kinesthetic intelligence, you're supporting the visual intelligence, and of course the musical intelligence, and areas of the brain that aren't lit up during, you know, math. And of course, math in ELA is so important, but this next era, I will feel, at least our work is going to really push this, is that music is just as important as math. You know, theater is just as important as ELA, and visual art is just as important as sciences, because they go hand in hand. And there's certain areas of the brain, I believe the cerebellum, that's responsible for balance, right? You maintaining your balance. But they saw that a big part of it is quietly responsible for just a lot of, like, not necessarily executive function, because that happens in the prefrontal cortex, but a lot of these underlying processes that are so important to just making decisions in other areas. And that part gets engaged when you're moving, when you're dancing. And so all of these aspects are coming into play, that we can no longer deem the artistic development, you know, which is connected to the creative development, as like extracurricular activities. Watch the businesses in the next 10 years will be having, and I spoke to a medical doctor during the interview, what is your arts background? And there are medical schools that in the interview, they ask you, do you play a musical instrument? Have you ever played the piano? Because they understand what is going on in the brain and how that puts you in an advantage than someone who does not have musical training. So I believe your work, my work, and the work of others will really be key this next decade to really push this forward.
Fantastic. And it also reminds me of a conversation we had with Vlad Glavino on season one of our podcast, where we talked about sociocultural creativity and context and the importance of context. And what's interesting to me, and Janine, I'd love your thoughts on this, is the fact that if we look at our educational systems, who's developing the standards, who's developing, you know, the student learning outcomes, and then it's not the teachers in the classroom who are sitting there in front of their students. It's people that are in a totally different, you know, environment. And all of a sudden they're making these decisions for these students that they don't even know anything about. So what are your thoughts on that? And what might we look at doing in the future that can help with that?
I think my interesting position that I always open my keynote with is the fact that I started my career as a K-5 teacher. So, you know, teaching little 4-year-olds a clap on the beat and teaching, you know, hot cross buns on the recorder. Oh, hot cross buns. And then I started a nonprofit for the graduates of my elementary school. So I was working with 6th through 12th graders, you know, working on financial literacy, education, or creative literacy and entrepreneurship. And then I was asked to teach at the local university, CSUN, California State University, Northridge, and teaching teachers how to get their, how to integrate the arts and integrate creative thinking into their curriculum. And then I was on the board of DonorsChoose.org, which is a nonprofit that helps teachers get supplies into their classroom. And this is all like within the same week. This isn't over a 15-year career. Like one day I'm working with a 4-year-old, and then a 16-year-old, and then a 64-year-old, and then sitting next to a person running LinkedIn, and then helping a child, you know, go to the bathroom, right? You know, or whatever, in one week. And so I got an interesting position of the pipeline, right? And so that told me, number one, we're not communicating well. K-5 is not communicating with 6-12, and we're definitely not communicating with higher ed like we should be. And the school system is not communicating with the workforce. You know, companies like Google and other companies are starting to get fed up. So they're starting to create their own education programs in-house. And so communication between these pipelines that our kids are experiencing the whole way through from 5 years old all the way to, you know, 65 years old. And so that's one thing. Another thing is give more teachers autonomy, more voice at the table, at the, policy making table, and students, because we have to understand, like I mentioned before, the demographics are changing and the needs of the workforce are changing. You've heard this big push about emotional intelligence, right? That just hit the scene. Business world now, education world, what, 10 years ago or so? It's not really that old. And because the neuroscience, I talk about this in my last keynote to the superintendents, the neuroscience says that emotion leads, content follows. The brain learns through emotion first, and then it can take into the logic content and whatever academic information you have. And so if there's no emotional connection, it's, you know, you're not going to really get that deep learning. And so teachers know that, and they have to be supported to be able to do that. Another aspect is multi-sensory learning. People in offices making the standards of curriculum are just writing it down. If you're in the area and you're in the position of knowing how to make this content come alive, you can create better content, you know, of how do I integrate all of the senses, because if you want the brain to really be able to retrieve, the more information it has to encode, the better. And so so we have to give just more power to the people on the front lines and to the students as well, because they're the ones that we're sending into this VUCA environment. So they have to know how to shift, how to adapt, how to pull information, and how to make these metaphorical connections and how to make these unobvious associations, which is the root and the foundation of creative thinking.
Would you say that the emotional aspect then is somewhat of the tool to bridge the gap between knowledge acquired and then meaning in the world?
Yes. And building images, you know, whether they be oral images, visual images, because the way the brain works to make meaning, it's pulling, trying to pull all these other aspects, you know, together of, you know, and memory. Dr. Lisa Fieldman Barrett does a lot of work on emotions. And the brain, she's a neuroscientist. So, you know, what do our memories have to do with emotions? Do we actually, you know, build emotions in real time? So there's a lot of work being done, and I'm still learning myself. But I can guarantee that if there is no emotional connection, even if they do well on the test, it's gone. I mean, come on, I don't remember half the things, but the stories, the memories that I do remember are those teachers that invested that emotional connection with the content, you know, and that was huge. I remember mining for gold in the sixth grade, you know, as we were learning about the gold rush. That will never leave me, because he built a whole picture around it, Mr. Miller, my sixth grade teacher. So teachers who know how to storytell, right? The brain is wired for story automatically. You don't even have to work to get the brain to understand story. It's wired for story. So if you look at my keynotes and the way I facilitate and the way I taught in the classroom, everything was positioned in story, because the brain needs that content to really move it to that next level of understanding.
Just listening to you, Janine, I've just been overwhelmed with all of your responses and my mind's kind of exploding. But, you know, some of the things that I'm thinking about what I could do immediately in response to what you said, and I'm kind of saying, have I ever done this before? Because it seems really easy, is pose a question. How do you feel about these ideas? Not necessarily which ideas are the best, but how do you feel? How do you think other people might feel about your ideas? What meaning do you think this idea has to this person? What meaning do you think this idea has this person? And just posing those questions maybe at the end of the lesson for students to go away and think about might be enough to at least begin making those connections.
Well, I think you really hit something there, Matt, which connects with what Janine is saying. And that is in the Torrance incubation model, and E. Paul Torrance, Janine, as you know, is the father of creativity and education. And he had this model where teachers could arouse curiosity and heighten anticipation. So that's where that emotional spark is that immediately leads students into saying, oh, wait, I want to learn about this, or I'm excited about this, or getting curious about that. And then as they go through the lesson to extend the learning so that they continue to think about that content for which they just learned about. So it's not just I walk into a classroom, I sit down, I learn something, I walk away, I forget about it, which is honestly, and I think we were all raised in the same generation, that's pretty much most of our schooling, right? You might have had one or two teachers that did something different, but how do you get students excited about learning? And I think for me, and I'm wondering if you're seeing the same thing, Janine, but for all the educators I work with, they say, you know, they say, I'm having a hard time getting my students excited about learning. And I have my own children who are like, you know, school, it's okay. You know, my son especially is really struggling. He's like, I'm not excited about going into the classroom. And learning should be an exciting place and a fun place and an engaging place. But I think because we have all these standards, it's hard to navigate that for a lot of teachers. But there are simple strategies, as we both know, and we both utilize that they can use.
One thing that I love is something that I call start with art. And we have to understand that internal motivation is connected to curiosity. Curiosity is huge. You know, on my podcast, I think it's episode 74, I sat down with Dr. Allison Hoistmeister out of USC, who has her doctorate in workplace curiosity, right? And she said that curiosity, you know, in the next 10 years is going to be the defining factor for your C-suite, your CEOs. CEOs who do not have high levels of curiosity, organizations are going down. You have your Kodak, your Blockbuster, your Radio Shack. That's what happens when you don't have a leadership who knows how to lead with curiosity, because curiosity pushes you to explore around the corner, right? And you're not just exploring the resources you have now, you're actually in that exploration phase. And I talk about that in the book that I need to send both of you. And once teachers get, I mean, a lot of them already have this, but once we really see, okay, well, where's the curiosity element in my lesson plan? You know, I believe we need a creativity objective. You know, we have our math objective, our ELA objective, our ELD, English language development objective, but there's no creativity objective. And that's a huge push that we're pushing for this next decade. But curiosity, and so I tell people, if creativity is the driver of innovation, curiosity is a driver of creativity. Because it's that wanting to know, that I feel I'm missing something, so I have to know. And so I say I'm not the inventor of intercultural creativity. My mother is, because she created a home of intercultural creativity, of curiosity, and exposing us to people with different lived experiences and different new experiences and multisensory experiences. So I just try to replicate that in my own classroom. And so start with art is, so let's say I'm teaching about Frederick Douglass petitioning Abraham Lincoln to bring in Black soldiers into the Civil War, right? Now I can come in, read the chapter, you know, answer questions and do it the normal quote unquote way. Or I can just show you a picture, a beautifully painted picture of this man pleading to another man who resembles Lincoln and his cabinets behind him. And I do this in my graduate course. And I just ask you, like, what's going on? And the kids, you know, or the students just like, okay, well, who is he? You know, and it's funny to do it with adults, because adults, half the adults don't even know that's Frederick Douglass, you know? And so the kids have to read the face. If you look at Lincoln's face, and I can send you this picture, it's a powerful photo. Like, he looks angst, like the emotion shown on these people's faces, the kids have to read it. And there's your emotional intelligence training right there. There's your training on, okay, well, how did the artists use shading to communicate that this is a serious conversation? They're not at the park, you know, licking lollipops and playing with balloons. They are talking about something serious. And so we have a conversation. And then we get into the content, because the kids are emotionally engaged with, you know, well, what's going on? And then they start making up stories, and then we get to see, well, okay, well, who's on the right track? And so just things like that. You could start anything with any type of art that doesn't give you the final answer, because we have to train our kids to be okay with ambiguity, with not knowing. You have to be okay with not being in a comfortable, I know everything situation, because life does not have the answers in the back of the book. At least my life does not have the answers in the back of the book. I have to take it step by step, be aware of my surroundings, take in data in real time and have feedback and make mistakes and have feedback and keep going. And so in order to train our kids that way, we have to start implementing that type of thinking within the curriculum. And starting with art is a great way to have them be curious, but also have them be okay with ambiguity and learning step by step what's going on.
So Janine, Matt and I would like to talk about some of our favorite gems of your 7 gems of intercultural creativity. So let's look at them just a bit to give our listeners a taste of the sparkle that they bring. So gem 2, you write about empathetic imagination. So can you talk a little bit about empathetic imagination?
Sure. I introduced this concept from the business world and then, attach it to the classroom as well. I sat down with Mitch Cohan on my podcast episode 2, and he sat down with 20 self-made billionaires, right? And what was this underlying thread that really helped them to be massive producers where they are? And the first thread that he talks about was empathetic imagination. So empathy is a cultural competence skill. Imagination is a creative skill. So you see the tie there. I tell people it's not about being a billionaire, but it is about creating value wherever life puts you. That's the point that I want people to understand. And having the position of knowing with empathy where your people are coming from or where your students are coming from just shoots you up in your ability to perspective shift and to help make the connections that's going to light the brain up and engage the brain and hook the brain into what you're trying to teach. And that imagination, for in the business world, to have the imagination of where the customer could possibly be going or what they may possibly need, your imagination of the teacher and the child is the most powerful tool probably in the classroom, because it's unlimited. There's no limit to what we could do with this information, what we can create. That's why I say that there should be a creative objective along with the other objectives. Because, okay, you learn this information. Now, what are you going to do with it besides put it on a Scantron? We got to get past the Scantron, right? And the kids, and there's your curiosity, motivation, your internal motivation. The kids are excited, like, okay, well, what can I create with what I just learned? And so there's your empathetic imagination. And the kids are going to say, well, what can I create that affects my life, that affects my family and community with what I just learned? There's your empathetic imagination within the classroom.
And I feel like there's connections to be had there with gem number 5, because gem number 5, and of course there's connections with all of the gems, but gem number 5 talks specifically about perspective shifting. And the reason why I'm making that connection is that in order for us to shift our perspectives, we of course need to be informed and knowledgeable of the different perspectives that exist in an environment. And how I see it is the only way to do that is to engage questions and empathy for other people and other people's views. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about how teachers might go about challenging children to, or young people to, shift perspectives of an outcome or interpretation of a material that they've made in the classroom environment.
Sure. I tell people it's hard to give what you're not yourself. So I start with the educator or whoever's the authority figure in the classroom first. And we need to talk about the elephant in the room, the ego. And so for people to really adequately or very well shift perspective, we have to lower the ego and be in a position of saying, I don't know. I need to learn more. And so for the whole leadership style in the 80s, you don't do that. You know, I'm the leader. I know everything. You do as I say. And even in the classroom, you know, I'm the sage on the stage. I have all the information. You learn directly from me. So to now dismantle that mindset and say, hey, I'm the lead learner. We're all in this together, is the first step in order to be able to shift perspective well. Another thing on my podcast, I talked with Dr. Michael Platt, who's looking at, okay, well, what's going on in the brain when we're shifting perspective when we're getting out of our own head and into someone else. He talked about the marginalized network. And that is our ability to really see life from another point of view and to try to emotionally connect from that point of view as well. And leaders and teachers who are able to do that are able to see unobvious connections that other people may be missing as well. So when you're able to fully shift perspective as an educator, you're also able to see even more connections that the child can make, because now you're seeing things from their point of view as well. And you're able to produce questions to have the child challenge beliefs. What we need to understand is to think creatively and to make connections with people who are of different lived experience. Metabolically, that's expensive for the brain. The brain has only so much energy a day to really dole out. It's trying to keep your systems going, trying to make sure you're breathing and everything, your food's digesting. There's only so much energy a day that the brain has. And so when we're asking our students to do this, we need to make sure that these other elements are okay. You know, they're fed, they're safe. And that's why psychological safety and inclusion is so important for creative thinking, because the brain doesn't want to give away that energy if it's not psychologically safe and there's a threat, you know, or perceived or real. And so making sure those elements are okay is key. And the questions that teachers can really ask are to help the child on their own kind of shift in their own way. So, you know, like, okay, well, what is making you say that? If you were this, you know, this particular character, what would they see? And here's where you can engage this multi-sensory in the imagination aspect, because the brain doesn't know the difference between imagination and what's really going on. The same thing, this get lit up. And so if the kids are closing their eyes and now imagining themselves as the protagonist or the antagonist, you know, to defend from a position that you don't agree with, that's difficult. And that's taking up some energy. But to imagine that, and you can see what's going on. Okay, now I can hear what's going on and I can feel. Are we allowing our kids to engage all of their senses so they can shift even better? Because, oh, now I'm aware of this. And so I just do all of these things with my kids, and it just really prepares them for what they're going to experience in the real world when they have to shift perspectives every day in different types of jobs and wherever they're going through.
You know, I've really recognized my responsibility to enter the classroom environment. And when I share a perspective, I've got to work really hard to not allow my students to necessarily assume that perspective as being absolute, and instead to try and challenge them to receive my perspective, to interpret it, and then begin to think about it from their perspective and how are they making sense of the same situation that I'm sharing with them.
Yes. If I can jump in there, two things that you shared that is a good tip that they can implement now is to share last. A lot of times when we want to give our perspective first, that may skew some of the perspectives of the students, but for the teacher to share their perspectives, but allow the kids to get all of their ideas out first. And, you know, you can go whichever way you want after that, but knowing that as the leader, as an authoritative figure, children are coming in with that cultural significance. You know, in some cultures, you know, the leader is always right, no matter what, you know. And so if you share first, that might skew them. So really having all the ideas come out first. And then the second thing that I do is I just say thank you. So let's say I say 2 plus 2, you know, what's two plus two? And a child raises their hand, says 4. You know, I could say, yes, it's 4. But all the other hands go down. Well, what if one of those hands said, well, 10 minus 6, is that correct? Yeah, 2 plus 2 does equal 10 minus 6, right? How about the square root of 16? You know, so once I say, yes, that's correct, and I don't allow all the other answers to come out before we kind of judge it, I kind of lose access to all the other ways that the students might be interpreting the questions. So I just say, thank you, thank you, thank you. And then is there anything else anyone else wants to share? And then we'll go into whatever direction we need to go in. So to really cultivate a creative classroom, we want to make sure we get all those creative ideas out first before we judge, and then we can go into that that convergent type of thinking, but that divergent type of thinking is going to be really key for a skill set for the workforce.
Well, Matt, we're running out of time with Janine, and I think we could talk for several days. But Janine, I really want to focus. When I met with you a few months ago and talked to you about your work, you mentioned that you have a son. So I'd love to hear how your work has influenced you being a mom, because we have a lot of parents that are out there listening.
So the parent is a first teacher. And I remember saying that to an organization during the first wave of the pandemic. And they were like, man, it's like, just calm down. You were their teacher before they ever went to school. And so that gave them that confidence. And even though I worked as a teacher for kindergarten through sixth grade or fifth grade, I got them at five. And so birthing my own son and seeing what happens in the brain from zero to he's about to turn four in a few weeks has been phenomenal. And now going through the neuroscience and seeing what is going on in the brain, number one, it's making me very sad at our nation that we're not putting more funding and resources to early education, because the first 5 years, and you've heard this on commercials and stuff, but now we really see it's true. The first 5 years of a person's life sets up the foundation for their entire life. How plastic the brain is. So you're born with all the neurons that you're basically going to have, but those neurons are not connected. The experiences that the child goes through is what connects those neurons. The languages that the child hear, the music, the dancing, the movement, all of this is critical. And when my son was born, they said, oh yeah, he's so alert. Well, yeah, because I was teaching music while I was pregnant. So he was in music class for 6 hours a day, you know, and the child, the infant can hear, the fetus can hear at five months gestation, right? And he could feel me swaying. And so the nurse, before she even said congratulations, she said, wow, he's really alert. And so that's why, I wrote my book, I'm So Creative, which I can send you this copy as well, just to give parents and teachers a heads up of, hey, this is what creativity looks like. Be mindful of the stuff right now, because if you're mindful of the 0 through 6 years, you know, the neurons start fading away, the ones that aren't used, by like 4 or 5 years old. So before they even get to our classroom, it could be, I don't want to say too late, but you've lost a lot of time. So I hope our nation really starts to take this seriously and support and fund our early education. The fact that a preschool teacher makes $20,000 a year is ridiculous. Ridiculous. And we're harming our future workforce because we're not building the neural structures that they need to be successful in K-12 and beyond.
So Janine, our time is wrapping up, but we do have a question that we ask all of our interviewees. What are 3 tips that you would give to educators or administrators out there who want to bring creativity into the classroom? What are 3 easy tips?
Think about your metaphors. There's miracles in the metaphor. So just bring it into your day, you know, like how is the bark of a tree, like your administration, you'll just have fun metaphorical games within yourself, but bring it into your lessons and into, if you're an administrator, bring it into your meetings, because they give you alternate gates to enter into the content with. And so we do a lot of metaphorical work in my home and in my facilitations as well. So that's one. The other one is, you know, the arts are key, even though creativity isn't solely artistry. Artistry helps in creativity. So in my business, we even have mandated art time. Like my employee has to go do a pottery class. So like she gets to choose her art. But, you know, you have professional development in other areas. Why not include that? So that's another one. And the other one is observation is key. You can't be creative if you have no data to be creative with, because creativity is all about combining and recombining sensory information your brain and body is bringing in. So your body is an instrument of thought, and so are all of your other senses. So really take a time, go walk outside, close your eyes, and listen to the birds. Something as simple as that can change your life.
And Janine, one more thing. You mentioned that you have a podcast, and I didn't mention that at the beginning of the episode. Can you share with us the name of the episode so we can make sure we can include that in the links below?
Sure. It's what's called the Create and Grow Rich podcast, but I'm changing it to the Create and Grow podcast. And there's many episodes there. I don't know if you needed me to particular specifically point out which one. But if you're interested in neuroscience, I have Dr. Michael Platt, episode 66 and 79 are the two neuroscientists I bring on the show. Curiosity, episode 74. And they're all great. We just bring great, just great thought leaders. And hopefully Miss Cindy will come on the show as well. And just really talk about what it means to be interculturally creative in this world today.
Well, thank you so much. I love the book, and I encourage those of you who are listening to go and check the book out and check out Janine's website. She's got a really comprehensive website, and I think you'll find lots of great information on this topic. So if you have any questions about this episode or questions you'd like us to ask in future episodes, please send us an email to questions@fuelingcreativitypodcast.com. That's questions@fuelingcreativitypodcast.com. My name is Dr. Cindy Burnett.
And my name is Dr. Matthew Werwood.
This podcast was produced by Creativity and Education and in partnership with dadsforcreativity.com. Our editor is Sina Yousefzadeh.